You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 164 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled The Value of Thinking for a Cognition that Satisfies the Human Being. This is Lecture 9. These lectures were translated by Christian von Arnim, and this was given in Dornach on the 4th of October, 1915. In our discussion of Wrangel's pamphlet, we have come to the chapter, which begins on page 37, and is entitled Materialism. I will begin by reading this little chapter. Quote, Materialism. As previously stated, the materialist view recognizes only such findings as can be gained through sensory perceptions and logical conclusions based on them, and denies the reality of occult perceptions. The sensory perceptions of most people do not provide direct evidence for the reality of spiritual forces and phenomena, which are not bound to material bodies. From this, the materialist concludes that the assumption of such forces and beings independent of matter is not justified, and declares the conclusions to be drawn from this to be worthless. According to them, world events are the necessary consequence of the forces and states present in matter from the beginning, which permit only one course, and which, according to the law of the dissipation of energy, must finally lead to the state of equilibrium, consequently to eternal death. The intellectual task of the human being was to investigate the laws according to which the course of such world evolution proceeds in order to endure as little suffering and waste of energy as possible by adapting to these laws. If the occult proofs for the existence of spiritual entities are rejected on principle, then logically there can be no objection to the materialistic outlook. Close quote. We indeed see characterized here in a few concise sentences the essence of the materialistic train of thought. But in order to achieve clarity about the whole significance of the materialistic worldview in our time, we must actually take various things into account. We must be clear that those who have become honest materialists in our time do indeed find it difficult to arrive at a spiritualistic worldview. And when we speak of honest opponents of spiritualism, we must first and foremost consider the theoretical materialists, for those people who believe from the outset, I would like to say professionally, that they must represent this or that worldview need not always be called honest representatives of a worldview. But Ludwig Büchner, for example, was an honest representative of materialism in the second half of the 19th century, more honest than many, who, from some religious point of view, as they think, believe themselves to be opponents of a spiritual worldview in the sense of spiritual science. Well, I said the materialists have a hard time coming to a spiritual worldview. For materialism, as it appears to us today, among those who say, yes, the human being has their senses and perceives the world through the senses, they observe the processes which the senses can follow and cannot, on the basis of what the senses present to them, come to the assumption of a spiritual entity which is independent of the world of the senses. This materialism has emerged with a certain necessity from the development of modern humanity, for it is based on something which had to come in the development of modern humanity. Anyone who takes the trouble to study the older spiritual life of humankind will find that it came to an end with the 14th, 15th, and 16th centuries among the actual civilized peoples. Today we need only really look into what the present can give to the consciousness of the human being, and then take a book in our hands which, with regard to its conception, still stands completely within the way in which the world was viewed scientifically in the 13th, 14th, and 15th centuries. And we will find that the human being of today, if they take things seriously and with dignity, no longer has and can no longer have a correct understanding of what is really said in the older literature, up to the turning point I indicated. Of course, it happens, but really only among those who are dilettantes. Indeed, even among those who have not yet become dilettantes, that they repeatedly dig out all kinds of page-turners from this older literature that deal with natural science, and then come to all kinds of judgments about what is supposed to be contained profoundly in them. But anyone who values a true relationship with what they make their own will have to conclude that the human being of today cannot really have true relationships with this older way of looking at nature. It is different with the philosophical views, but the view of nature of more ancient times doesn't really mean a lot to the person of today, because all the concepts they can form about nature are only a few centuries old, and we have to approach nature with these today. Our physical concepts basically all go back to the Galilean worldview and nothing earlier. It takes extensive historical academic study to engage with earlier works of natural science. For the precise investigation of the material world, the outer world of the senses, in whose current we find ourselves today, has actually only begun in the last few centuries. You will remember that we have just been talking about measurement in connection with Wrangel's booklet. Measuring also includes weighing, as we have seen. However, introducing weighing as an instrument in scientific methods has only been common since about Lavoisier, so it is not yet older in this way than 150 years, and all the basic ideas of today's chemistry, for example, are based on such weighing. Again, if we want to develop ideas today, for example, about the action of electrical forces, or even just of thermal forces, they must be those that take into account the research from the last half of the 19th century. People today can no longer cope with the older conceptions. Similarly, we could say the same in relation to biological science. However, anyone who needs to know the evolution of science should also get to know the older literature. But we who want to cultivate spiritual science seriously must get out of the habit of what we so often encounter with so-called theosophists. I have often spoken about how, for example, I got to know a community of theosophists in Vienna in the 1880s. It was almost a kind of custom to pick out all kinds of old page-turners and read up on things that really weren't understood very well, because basically it takes quite a lot to read a scientific work, for example, from the 14th century. But people form judgments. These judgments were always pretty much the same. Namely, when someone once again pretended to have read such a book, they only leafed through it, they said profoundly deep, or some similar verdict. At the end of the 80s, I heard no phrase as often, relatively speaking, of course, as the words profoundly deep. Of course, I also often heard the word shallow. What we must bear in mind is the great significance of the views, concepts, and ideas which have been acquired under the influence of the views of the last centuries. When you have experienced the explanations of the basic mechanical concepts, when you consider the abundance of physical, chemical, and biological concepts, and also many things that have been collected in order to see how the soul expresses itself in the outer physical body, then we have before us, as a result of the last centuries, and especially of the second half of the last century, tremendously extensive research results. And these research results must necessarily be acquired, not only because all external, technical, economic, and material life, which humanity has had to achieve, is based on them, but also because a large part of our conception of the world is based on them. And you are actually, even if in a certain respect it does no harm in a limited field, but it is true nevertheless, you are actually wet behind the ears in terms of a worldview such as that of today's science, if you don't know anything about physics, biology, and so on, as they have developed today. Certainly it must be emphasized time and again that the research results of spiritual science are obtained on the basis of those perceptual abilities that have often been spoken about. They cannot be obtained in the same way, although with the same certainty, as the scientific materialistic results. And of course, if you devote yourself to what was indicated yesterday, this spiritual science is a reality. But for our present time, for our present, much more is necessary than just somehow having a spiritual relationship with the results of spiritual science, which can certainly be grasped by common sense. It is much more necessary to familiarize ourselves with the materialistic worldview, at least with an extract of it, than to somehow snatch scraps of the spiritual world, if we want to be able to really represent to the outside world today what spiritual science intends. For you cannot stand before the world and truly represent spiritual science if you have no idea of the way the scientist undertakes research today, how they must think and how they must manage research alongside elucidation. And if you always disdain to pick up a scientific book in order to acquaint yourself with the natural sciences of today, you will never be able to avoid committing clumsy acts when advocating the spiritual scientific worldview in relation to that which is the sediment of the external worldview. Today it is also much less important to listen to the traditional systems of religion than to the honestly obtained respectable results of materialistic research. You just have to be able to relate to these materialistic research results in the right way. Just to show what we are dealing with at the present moment, let us pick out a field. Let's take the field of human anatomy and physiology. If you pick up any common book today, and I have always recommended such books in the course of many cycles, you will get a picture of how the physiologist of today builds up their ideas about the structure of the human body on the basis of the bone system, the cartilage, tendon, muscle systems, the main nervous, blood, sensory systems, and so on. And a picture will emerge of how people today, living in materialistic thoughts, imagine the interaction, say, of the heart and the lungs, and again of the heart with the other vascular systems of the body. Then an answer can be found to the question, how does a person today, who has acquired their concepts from materialistic research, actually relate to these things? What conceptions do they actually have living within them? And here it has to be said, significant conceptions have indeed been obtained. Conceptions that had to be obtained in such a way as to really refrain from anything spiritual, from bringing spiritual thoughts into research. It was simply necessary to get involved with the material realm as it presents itself to the five senses, as the saying goes, and with the connection that arises with the five senses. It was simply necessary to read the world in this way. And much remains to be done in this field, in all kinds of fields of scientific research. But now suppose for a moment that you have acquired such a picture of the structure of the human body as the anatomist and physiologist have today. Then you will find that the anatomist and the physiologist say, well, the human being is built up of various organs and organ systems, and these work together in a certain way. You see, when today the anatomist, the physiologist, speaks and summarizes their conceptions into an overall picture of the human being, then within this picture, underlying the same, sensory observation remains. This gives rise to very specific conceptions that can be taken up, but you have to relate to them in the right way. I can, perhaps, make this clear by way of a comparison. For example, someone could say, I want to meet Raphael. What do I have to do? I would say to them, if you want to get to know Raphael, then try to immerse yourself in Raphael's paintings. Study the title Marriage of the Virgin from the Milan paintings, then the various paintings up to the title Sistine Madonna, up to the title Assumption, and get an idea of how Raphael tried to distribute the figures in space, how he tried to distribute light and shadow, to enliven one place in the picture at the expense of the other, to make one stand out and the other recede, and so on. Then you will know something about Raphael. Then you will perhaps be prepared to learn even more about Raphael. Then you will gradually get a picture of the configuration of Raphael's soul, of what he wanted, of the sources in his mind from which the creations emerged. Now, you could imagine someone coming and saying, "Oh, looking at the paintings, that doesn't suit me. I'm a clairvoyant, and I look directly into Raphael's soul. See how Raphael created, and then talk about Raphael." I can imagine someone coming and saying, "I don't need to see anything by Raphael at all, but immerse myself directly in Raphael's soul." Naturally, this would be considered nonsense in Raphael's studies, but in the field of spiritual science it is practiced a great deal, despite the many warnings in all the years that we have been doing spiritual science. You could see how few felt compelled to use the literature that has been mentioned in the course of the lecture cycles, and to use it in such a way as to get a picture of what materialistic research has delivered. But just as you would go wrong if you stopped at the picture and did not want to progress to the soul element, which is expressed through the picture, so the materialist stops. What you could say to the materialist, for example, is this: "Yes, you are looking at a picture, but you do not consider that what you are looking at should be seen as the outer revelation of a spiritual inwardness." But it is true that materialistic research has gathered an immense wealth of material. If you consider this as an outer revelation of a spiritual inwardness, you are on the right path. The materialist only makes the mistake of having the material and not wanting to accept that it is the expression of something spiritual. But on the other hand, you will always remain in the wrong if you claim something spiritual and the materialist tells you things of which you have no idea. Of course, you can survey the abundant field of research and still have no clue about a great many things. But you have to have an idea of the way things are acquired. And if our school of spiritual science will serve to enable a number of people who have studied one or other of these fields to interpret the basic materialistic conditions that are necessary according to the present development, then our school of spiritual science will accomplish a great deal. We could certainly do it today by saying that the material laid down in our cycles could suffice. We could conclude with this and use the time ahead to demonstrate to our friends the basic material preconditions that must be in place. You will then certainly see, if you look at today's physics, chemistry, and biology in a corresponding way, that what is in our cycles will result. Then you would have adopted the right attitude toward materialism. People are on completely the wrong track, my dear friends, when they talk about materialism being wrong. What nonsense! To say that materialism is wrong is just like saying the Sistine Madonna has blue here, red there. Surely that's wrong. It's only matter. Materialism is right in its field. And if we take what it has contributed to human knowledge, it is something immense. It is not necessary to fight materialism, but only to show in its development how materialism, when it comprehends itself, leads beyond itself, just as I have shown how anatomy and physiology lead beyond themselves and necessarily lead into the spiritual field. All we can do is ask, why are there so many people who, instead of accepting materialism as a mere method of research, stop at it as a worldview? The right thing to say would be that today it would indeed be something completely perverse and foolish to do alchemy instead of chemistry. You have to do chemistry today and not alchemy like in the 12th century. That goes without saying. But it is necessary to ascend from today's research into spiritual life. If our friends would only take the trouble to study the little booklet titled Haeckel and His Opponents, they would find that all its underlying thoughts are dominated by the basic biogenetic law. It is quite telling that we have not yet managed to publish a second edition of this little text titled Haeckel and His Opponents. And yet it is extremely important to keep informed, even if not about the latest research results. You don't necessarily need to know them in detail, but about the way the researcher proceeds and how they follow their research method. This is of exceptional importance. If someone says, I don't need to study that book, what do I need to do that for? For me, the spiritual world is clear from the beginning. I don't have to clamber up that ladder. If someone says that, they are today an egoist who only thinks of themselves and does not consider what the time demands of us. But we must pay attention to these things if we want to render service to the spirit of the time. It is extremely important that we focus on these things in particular. Certainly a person has a right to say, why do I need a scientific basis? For me, the spiritual world is clear. That may be true. But if we want to learn something in the field of the spiritual world, we can, of course, do it in such a way that we interpret what is there. But if we want to learn something, we must familiarize ourselves with what exists in materialistic science. On the other hand, we must ask, how is it that there are many anatomists, physiologists, physicists, chemists, and so on today, as natural scientists, and even those who call themselves experimental psychologists, and that they want to hold on to materialism not as a research method, but as a world view? Here we must, in all honesty, have the courage to answer. In order to do materialistic research, it is only necessary to stare at the world with the five senses and to use the external methods. You only need to surrender passively to the world, then you are firmly in place. Pulling apart a plant, counting the stamens, taking the microscope, staining a cross-section to then study the structure, and so on. I could, of course, list many more things. That's what people are capable of. All you have to do is stand there. Just be passive and let nature have its effect on you. You let nature take over. I called this the dogmatism of experience in the very first writings I published. The dogmatism of experience is what people adhere to. You can read what I say about the dogmatism of experience in my book titled Goethe's Theory of Knowledge, An Outline of the Epistemology of His Worldview. I also subsequently called it, in quotes, fact fanaticism. But in order to enter the spiritual world, it is necessary to work inwardly. Inward activity is necessary for this. And that is where people can definitely run out of steam. You can see in our time that the steam has run out. If you make comparisons in the field of anatomy, for example, you will find that you can almost point your finger at the point where the steam has run out. Take the anatomist Hertel, who was replaced as professor by the anatomist Langer. Compare the writings of the two scientifically, and you will see how, in the succession of the two scholars, one is absolutely clear about the fact that there is something spiritual behind the external, and the other is no longer concerned about it. Why is that? Because, commendable as materialism is as a method of research, having thereby produced great and mighty things without which people today could not live, people have been too lazy to bring up into active life what they have grasped. Laziness, real inertia of spirit, has made people persist in materialism. Because materialism became so dominant and claimed to be reality, that is why people did not ascend into the spiritual. It is laziness and inertia, and we must have the courage to see this reason. Immerse yourself in the fields of scientific research, and you will see that this scientific research is great and worthy of admiration. If you immerse yourself in all that is fabricated by the monists and other associations as world views, you will see that they are based on a laziness and inertia, on an ossification of thought. This is what must be clearly understood, that we must distinguish, if we stand on the ground of true spiritual science, between the entirely justified materialistic research methods and research results and the so-called materialistic worldview. Mostly, those who research materialistically cannot think at all, because it is easier to research materialistically than to think spiritually. I will give you an example to illustrate that the materialists simply stumble when they want to advance from the materialistic method of research to a worldview. So, let's say I have tried to obtain an atomistic worldview. So I want to say, bodies consist of atoms. You have to think of these in motion, so that when you have a material object in front of you, it consists, this is how we must think of it, of atoms. There are spaces between the atoms. The atoms are in motion, and through the motion, according to the materialistic worldview, heat is generated. If you were to say, heat is the result of the movement of atoms, then you would be right. Then you would only be affirming something. But you come to the view that it is impossible to speak of the atoms as something that actually exists. The atoms are thought up, and they must be thought up if they are to have any meaning. But what is observed is supposed to be caused in the first place by the atoms. So you can't see an atom. You can see the so-called atomistic view of the world is composed of nothing visible, of nothing perceptible by the senses. But now, you can reflect and say, the world consists of atoms and these are in motion. People want to investigate the nature of the movement that underlies heat, light, magnetism, electricity, and so on. And they come to assume that certain movements of the atoms are the causes of the sensory perception. So you end up with atoms. So you divide up what is given, and if you divide over and over again, you must eventually arrive at the indivisible, and that is the atom. Divisible atoms are meaningless. The last pieces, that is, the atoms, must be indivisible. Nowadays, however, people also want to explain movement from the atoms. I can only indicate this, but you can pursue it further in the philosophical, scientific literature of more recent times. They want to explain movement from the nature of the atoms. But if you think about how one atom has to collide with another so that the movement can result that you have with heat, electricity, and so on, then you cannot think of the atoms rigidly. Then you have to think of them elastically. It is necessary to think of them as elastic, for rigid atoms would not give the movement in a collision that must result if heat, electricity, or magnetism are to result. So these atoms must be elastic. But what does that mean? It means that the atom can be compressed and then springs back to its former state. So it has to be compressible and spring back again. Otherwise you can't conceive of the collision of the atoms at all. Now we have two things. First, the atom must be indivisible. Second, it must be elastic. Modern thinking, which pays homage to atomism, stands behind these two things. The atom must be thought indivisible, otherwise it is no longer an atom. And it must be thought elastic, for it would be a senseless idea to attribute atomic motion to rigid atoms. English thinkers in particular have emphasized these two propositions very keenly. Firstly, the atom is indivisible, and secondly, the atom must be thought of as elastic. If I allow a body to be elastic, it is inconceivable other than that the parts are compressed and then spring back into the original position to produce the elastic body. The latter is inconceivable without being divisible, movable. But the atom must be indivisible on the one hand and divisible on the other, otherwise it cannot be elastic. What does that mean? This means that if you want to imagine atoms, we come up with two contradictory basic assumptions. You can't get beyond these. There is tremendously interesting literature on thinking of our image of the world as composed of non-rigid atoms. But then the atom is no longer an atom, because it must be thought of as divisible. That is, you come to the conclusion that the idea of the atom is impossible, as long as you assume that the atom is material. In the moment when you think the atom is not material, when you think the atom is not something material but something else, the atom can be thought of as indivisible, just as the human eye, capital, is also thought of as indivisible. If you assume that the atom is a force, then you can also think of it as being composite. If you don't think materialistically, you don't need to think that there are spaces in between. So the two things are quite compatible if we think of atoms as non-material. If, taking careful account of what optics, the theory of electricity and so on, offers us, we draw the final conclusions as to how the atom must be, Then we come to say the atom cannot be material. This is where, of necessity, you enter into the spiritual. But you have to take this step. It then makes no difference whether the atom is elastic or rigid. We don't care about that. We don't go along with that. But materialism must not be fought, but understood. The great sum of work and positive achievements must not be scorned by spiritual science. Let us now move on to the next chapter of Wrangel's text. Quote, doubts about the materialistic worldview. But doubt arises in the mind of many a person. Should it really be the case that the world as a whole is not based on any rational, any moral thought, and that the concepts of the purposeful, the moral, arise only in the human breast, but have no validity outside it? We feel within us the striving toward good, and the concept of good is inseparable from the concept of freedom, for where there is absolute necessity, there is nothing evil or good. A stone must fall in a certain direction at a certain speed, and it would be pointless to call this fall evil or good. Should that which we feel in our innermost being to be the actual measure of life's value be only deception and delusion? And should this idea of the good, that is, of morality chosen in freedom, not be found in the world as a whole, of which the human being is only a negligible fraction? Should the minor part, the human being, endowed with sublime feelings and thoughts, stand higher in this respect than the whole, which, without consciousness, without a concept of purpose, follows its course like dead clockwork, ending in eternal death? Most people's minds resist such a solution and look for another. Close quote, Steiner again. It is good to speak of the mind resisting this, but it is much more important in our time to say that the thinking resists it. If you only want to stand on the ground of materialism, you have to go to the atom and conceive of it as matter. But you can also call it a force, and then you come to the conclusion that where matter is thought to be, that is where the cosmic world of thought is. Then the moral world order has its entire place in it. Now, however, some have found it more convenient to say, well, if you think about the world in this way, scruples and doubts arise everywhere for sensory knowledge, and it is not acceptable to allow such sensory knowledge to apply solely and exclusively. But it is simply the case that the human being is predisposed not to be able to penetrate deeper. This results in approximately the following situation. Here stands the human being who is perhaps a very good researcher in the field of the outer sensory world and who can produce enduring, beautiful, great things as a materialistic researcher, but they are not inclined to enter further into it. And so they say, there must be all kinds of things behind matter, but we are not capable of penetrating there with the human faculty of cognition. They call themselves agnostic. They do not realize that such words, the human being does not have the ability, and so on, are inspired by Ahriman. And they do not hear what good spirits inspire them with, that they don't listen to. In truth, they are just lazy. It's called laziness when you are honest. It's called agnosticism in science. The next chapter in Wrangel is now called, quote, agnosticism. The answer to the question as to the origin and goal of the world as a whole, and as to the destiny of the human being, which offers the least difficulty to the intellect, but leaves the demands of the mind completely unsatisfied, is the standpoint of the agnostic, one who does not know. When they say, these questions exceed the limits of human cognition, must therefore, by their very nature, remain unanswered, and it is more reasonable to devote one's time and energies to tasks where there is a prospect of managing them. Close quote. Steiner again. There is nothing wrong with saying, I want to devote myself to a task that I can manage. That lies in the freedom of the human being. But it is not within the human being's freedom to say, what I do not know, no one else may know. All philosophizing about what the human being cannot know is basically scientific infamy. And what's more, it is unparalleled scientific grandstanding. because you set yourself up as the ruler of what may and may not be researched, because you set up what you yourself want to assume as authoritative for everyone else. What impotence lies in the words, quote, "there are limits to cognition," close quote. But we should also realize what arrogance and self-regard lie therein. This should not be whispered into ears, but shouted out. Quote, "Without denying the existence of spiritual entities, the agnostic claims that this field is at any rate not accessible to everyone, whereas everything based on sensory experience is within the realm of knowledge of the normal human being, and they should be content with that. Those people in whom the critically trained intellect prevails can persist in this point of view without becoming paralyzed in their actions. But for most people this answer is no answer at all. If we place ourselves in the position of a person without personal occult experiences and without knowledge of reports of others about such perceptions, which appear credible to them, then logically judged, they are free to express themselves for or against the existence of spiritual worlds." Close quote, Steiner again. Of course, in human interaction, everyone is free to speak out against the existence of a spiritual world. But we should be clear that such a statement is worthless. You can also argue against 3 times 3 being 9. Quote, "But they are not entitled to deny scholarly status to the opposing view. The degree of credibility of the reports of others cannot be measured with objective, that is, universally valid rigor, and the judgment on this is necessarily influenced by subjective motives in each individual case." Close quote. Steiner again, "Yes, that can be shown. Quote, if it is a matter of facts that can be checked by any normal person, then in most cases a person does not need to take the trouble to check them personally, because with the present organization of scientific research, it is assured that an erroneous observation or false report will soon be discovered, and this forces every observer and reporter to be as careful and truthful as possible for the sake of their reputation alone, and in any case an observation error does not remain undiscovered for long." Close quote, Steiner again. Basically, that doesn't say much more than if someone were to state the following. With the way scientific work is organized today, if you go to Basel and buy a chemistry book, you can already believe what is written in it because it contains chemical results, and it cannot occur to a chemist to lie. But all that does is legitimize the belief in authority. And if people were to admit this to themselves, they would realize how much they accept in good faith today. I have often emphasized that spiritual science is at its beginnings, but can be tested. Spiritual science is still young. When it has grown older, then the same will apply with regard to the spiritual scientist as applies today with regard to the chemist. People will then realize that in spiritual science there is no lying. Quote, "With occult perceptions, on the other hand, it is different, and this essential difference has so long caused the men of exact science, who are accustomed to controllable facts, to be not only critical, that is scrutinizing, but skeptical, that is directly defensive, toward occult communications." Close quote, Steiner again. The real reason is that they are too lazy. Quote, "Now, however, this no longer seems possible, for the evidence for the immaterial existence of spiritual entities is so weighty that men of undoubted scientific training consider this question proven. Suffice it to recall names like Zöllner, Wallace, Duprell, Crookes, Butlerow, Rochas, Oliver Lodge, Flammarion, Morselli, Schiaparelli, Ochorowitz, James, and others." Close quote. Here, Mr. von Wrangel relies on those who draw on atavistic faculties, whereas we assume that every human being can acquire the faculties that enable us to test the spiritual in the same way as we test the scientific. Quote, "Not only do these men find no contradiction between occult facts and established results of exact sensory research, but their very habituation to unprejudiced criticism leads them to reject the skepticism of the materialist and to devote themselves to the study of occult phenomena. Close quote, Steiner again. But they do not do it in the right way. They drag everything down to the same laboratory level at which chemistry is located, even though these things can only be attained in free activity of thought. Instead of being inwardly creative, they go around with a yardstick, as it were, and measure. Quote, "These authorities may be mistaken in their judgment, but their standpoint can serve as proof that we are justified in supposing the existence of spiritual entities without exposing ourselves to the reproach of scientific ignorance. Assuming that we have no occult abilities ourselves, we have to rely on the reports of others and test them for their credibility." Close quote, Steiner again. It would be better if we tried to engage with what is said in title Knowledge of the Higher Worlds, How Is It Achieved? It is much easier than many think. Most people just don't acknowledge it. But all kinds of complexities are acknowledged. It would really be relatively very easy to experience, in a few years at least, as much of the spiritual world as is necessary to recognize it in general. But people say, that's not anything, because they strive for what I have called gut clairvoyance. And if there is no gut clairvoyance, then it all counts for nothing to them. Quote, "The sources of error in occult perceptions lie in both the subject and the object. Even a cursory examination of the perceptual material piled up by spiritualists and other occultists shows us that here, admittedly, the sources of error flow abundantly." Close quote, Steiner again. They truly do not. It is no different from saying nature never lies, but it lies all the time. Take a glass of water and put a stick in it, it will appear broken to you, but it isn't. Take the passage of the sun across the celestial vault. Compare its size in the morning and its size at noon. All day long, nature is lying to you. The spiritual world lies just as much and just as little. For example, it is exceedingly interesting to visualize the processes in the etheric part of the human being when you have an ailment in the intestines, or to observe what the etheric body does when the digestive processes are occurring. It is just as interesting as when you ordinarily study anatomy or physiology, indeed even more interesting. But what is not justified is to regard something which is nothing other than a process in the etheric body during digestion as a grand process of the cosmic world. So the spiritual world itself does not lie. You just have to interpret it in the right way. Nor is it necessary to despise what goes on in the etheric body during digestion. We just have to avoid misunderstanding it. Nor are the senses deceptive in reality. If you reach into the water, you will find with your sense of touch, in brackets there is a gap in the transcript. Over time, natural science has acquired good rules through study, while it is believed in spiritual science that the fewer studies a person has undergone, the better they are suited to it. So, quote, "even a superficial acquaintance with the perceptual material piled up by spiritualists and other occultists shows us that here, admittedly, the sources of error flow abundantly." Continue, quote, "For they lie not only, as in the sensory world, in the subject, but moreover in the object. In that, numerous malignant entities shall make it their task to mislead the inquiring human being. If we could rightly say of ordinary sensory perceptions, nature never lies, only human beings sometimes misunderstand it, it is different in the spiritual world, according to the occult researchers. Thus, if the reality of spiritual phenomena, independent of matter, is conceded, it is a great and difficult task to separate the wheat from the chaff there. This is the task of spiritual science, which, if it is to be pursued seriously, requires all the time and strength of a person, as is the case, incidentally, with every other branch of knowledge, though perhaps to a lesser extent. For the majority of people, however, such studies are neither possible nor even necessary. just as a person can be a Christian and find comfort and edification in the teachings of Jesus, see the moral ideal realized in his person without being a theologian, so a person can recognize in the basic teachings of theosophy an interpretation of the actual meaning and purpose of their own life without being familiar with the extensive edifice of occult science. Close quote, Steiner again. This is an assertion that cannot be sustained without further qualification. For if people are not chemists by training, if they are not biologists by training, it is nevertheless possible to live today. But the human being will progressively have to know those things that belong to the world to which the human soul itself belongs. It is a kind of unjustified rejection to say that in order to be a theosophist, you do not need to be familiar with occult science any more than you need to be a theologian in order to be a Christian. Quote, that worldview will be most conducive to the human being's actions and sensibilities, which most satisfies both their intellect and their feelings. Close quote, Steiner again. The next chapter is headed, quote, continued existence of the soul after death. If we assume that the spiritual principle in the human being, that which is described by the word soul, is an entity which continues to exist even after the death of the body, then various ideas are possible concerning its further fate, of which we shall only consider here the Christian conception and the teaching of reincarnation as being the most important for us at present. The teachings of Christ have been a source of comfort and moral strength to millions, and are likely to continue to be so. However, it cannot be denied that for the scientifically educated European, difficulties of an intellectual nature have accumulated and do not allow the struggle between faith and knowledge to be balanced on the basis of Christian doctrine. The existing contradiction requires a sacrifice, either of the intellect or of the mind. In addition to these intellectual difficulties, some people have grave moral misgivings about the usual understanding of Christianity. All Christian denominations teach that after death, the soul of the human being endures a fate that is eternal, eternal salvation or eternal damnation. Every human being probably feels that this belief contradicts the demand for justice. The basis of all morality is justice. Close quote. If only people knew a little more. Of course, Wrangel is right when he says that you cannot speak of eternal salvation and eternal damnation in this way, since they contradict justice. Because eternal is an absurdity if you believe that it is something infinite. Eternal is only an age, an eon. And actually, even in Christianity, we should not speak of eternal in any other way than as an age. And that corresponds roughly to the time between death and a new birth. Quote, in every human breast there lies deep and unshakable the desire that to each be done as they merit. The view of merit is admittedly changing, also the appreciation of what has been experienced and felt. But there can be no doubt that human beings would be happier, better, more satisfied, if they had the conviction that the events of the world as a whole also correspond to the demand for justice in the individual case. We do not see justice prevailing in what we experience in ourselves and others in the course of our physical life, regardless of whether we use soul, spiritual, or physical suffering and joy as a measure of the value of what we have experienced. According to the teachings of the Christian churches, this apparent injustice of earthly life is to be compensated for in the hereafter, but it is basically made infinitely worse by the everlasting consequences of temporal transgressions or merits. Close quote. Steiner again. It goes without saying that Wrangel is speaking only of what the Christian churches say, which arose after Justinian had closed the Greek philosophical schools. But he overlooks the fact that we have the task of making such blocked wisdom accessible to humanity again. You do not have to look for the right reasons. It could also be shown that those who teach Christianity today do not teach true Christianity, but one that has been made to fit. The next chapter is called, quote, Reincarnation and Karma. The teaching of reincarnation and karma, on the other hand, offers us the possibility of resolving the visible injustice of a life's destiny by the fact that it was self-inflicted in previous lives, and that there is the possibility of rectifying it for subsequent reincarnations. Such faith, when it becomes inner certainty, gives a person the strength to bear their fate, even the hardest one, without inner rebellion, and spurs them on to improve it for the future by following the voice we call conscience. The sense of responsibility present in our consciousness is strengthened, and the danger of humanity seeking to exploit the short span of temporal life in sensual frenzy and selfishness would be eliminated. The teaching of reincarnation and karma sets the human being free because it makes them reliant on themselves. Certainly the great riddle of the wherefore of the whole remains unresolved, but the purpose and task of the individual life are clear and determined. Close quote, Steiner again. The next chapter makes reference to the conclusion of Lessing's title, The Education of the Human Race. Quote, Lessing's view on the teaching of reincarnation. Is this hypothesis of reincarnation so ridiculous because it is the oldest? Because the human mind, before it was distracted and weakened by sophistry and school, immediately succumbed to it? Why should I not return as often as I am sent to gain new knowledge, new skills? Do I suddenly take away so much that it is not worth the effort to come back? According to the teaching of reincarnation, it is our lot to live on this earth until we reach our destination, knowledge of God, which is self-knowledge. Death is not annihilation. The consciousness of our I, capital, our actual being, merely enters another body. Even the suicide does not escape. They only cut the thread of life that must be reattached according to inexorable laws. Close quote. Steiner again. So said Lessing. Those were powerful words. But these were also the words of a man who had the education of his time within him and was necessarily led to the teaching of reincarnation by what this and Christianity could give him. We see here the remarkable learning. We see the critic of history. But now people say, of course Lessing is a great man. He wrote titled Nathan and so on. That's good. But having grown old, he indulged in such fanciful reveries as the teaching of reincarnation. There is no going along with that. Well, clearly the private tutor is much cleverer than Lessing became in old age. Many people believe, after all, that they are much cleverer than Lessing, although they are prepared to recognize that he might be a great man. We should at least realize the ridiculousness of such recognition. Realize that we must strive for what Lessing had worked his way toward in the end. We should realize the ridiculousness of not wanting to follow as far as this most mature fruit of Lessing's thought, let alone refusing to consider what has followed in more recent intellectual life. These people speak without addressing the actual basic core that already underlies modern intellectual life, but which is a closed book for many who interpret it. Well, Rangel goes on to say, quote, We know from what Eckermann and Boisserey said that Goethe also believed in reincarnation. Kant says in his Lectures on Psychology, quote, The beginning of life is birth, but this is not the beginning of the soul's life, but of the human being. Birth, life, and death are thus only states of the soul. Therefore the substance remains, although the body passes away. And therefore the substance must also have been there when the body came into being. Close quote, close total quote, Steiner again. Now, the last chapter follows. Quote, Brief summary of the line of reasoning. Let us try to briefly summarize the line of reasoning set out above. The concept of lawfulness, the necessary concatenation of cause and effect in events, is not an original cognition. On the contrary, immediate consciousness gives us the conception of conditional freedom. The concept of lawfulness, on which every science is based, probably first appeared to human beings from observation of the chronologically regular course of celestial phenomena. Then this concept was applied with ever-increasing success to the inanimate phenomena, physics, chemistry, then to the animate ones, finally also to the spiritual ones. The concept of lawfulness can only be tested and irrevocably proven in such phenomena that can be quantitatively determined, that can be measured. The extension of the idea of necessity from the material to the spiritual is an assumption which, by analogy with what happens in the material, can be granted a certain probability, but which cannot be proven because the touchstone of measurability is missing here. Numerous facts verified by discerning men of science do not permit any truth-seeking person to deny the existence of spiritual beings without providing evidence as to why they reject the facts in question and their evidential value. The basic teachings of theosophy, reincarnation and karma, do not contradict any scientific fact, satisfy the intellect, and, better than other teachings, satisfy the basis of all morality, the demand for fairness. Faith in these basic assumptions must strengthen the human being to endure undesired destinies in life and promote the striving for the good in them. Close quote. Steiner again. Now, my dear friends, this pamphlet is placed before us as a document of our time, as the expression of a person who stands firmly in the workings of scientific methods and wants to bear witness to the fact that it is possible to be a good, fully conscious scientist, and precisely, not in spite of this, but precisely because of it, to arrive at a worldview that recognizes the spirit. You will have seen from the last chapters of Mr. von Wrangel's pamphlet that he has not yet concerned himself very deeply with spiritual science, that he has not broached the difference between what spiritual science wants and dilettante theosophy. And therefore it is all the more important to see how someone who is scientifically trained asks for what can only really be given through spiritual science, so that we can say, we have come to know through such a pamphlet how an unprejudiced scientist can position himself with regard to a view that acknowledges the spirit. You can still draw other threads, and we will do that occasionally. In this way, we shall enter further into the matter, to cultivate spiritual science, not only in an egoistic way, but really to regard it as a cultural ferment, and through it to contribute to the course of development of humanity. That is the extremely important thing, that we get into the habit of really participating in everything. Sometimes you can experience something particular in our ranks. Don't be cross if I speak of this experience, but it can really be had. For there are certain members in our ranks who say, public lectures, they are not important for us. And they say this in a way from which one can see how they do not really participate. They say the public lectures, that's not the most important thing. The branch lectures, yes, they are for us. But we have progressed beyond what the public lectures give. And yet it is precisely the case that the public lectures are designed for those who have a connection with the outside world. And much more reference is made to contemporary science in the public lectures than in the private lectures, which show how very often delicate consideration must be given to the fact that people do not like to take strictly scientific questions as a basis. And this delicate consideration is often interpreted in such a way that people say, the public lectures are not so important. In truth, something else is the case. In these things, too, there is just a certain kind of egoism that underlies them. I don't want to take up arms for the public lectures. I just want to challenge the baseless opinion that many people have. It may be easier to omit this or that connecting strand in the branch lectures in one place or another, but the public lectures must be structured strand by strand. Many people who in their work are not involved in the entire cultural process of our time don't like that. But it is precisely such engagement in the cultural process of the time, such not closing yourself off, that is important. It is, of course, also easier to talk about angels, Lucifer and Ahriman, than about electrons, ions, and so on. But you see, we also have to be aware that we have to draw the threads toward the present culture. But I would ask you not to take the matter one-sidedly again, as if I were to ask you to buy the entire Gershon scientific collection tomorrow and sit down to cram, as the students would say, the whole of it, bit by bit. That is not what I mean at all. I only mean that where we wish to speak authoritatively about the position of spiritual science in our culture, we must also have an awareness of it, and should not lapse into the mistake of saying that this external science is sheer invention. You can certainly say, as an individual, that you don't have time to concern yourself with it. But the whole institution, the whole operation, should be given a certain direction by what I have said. And it should come as no surprise that a school of spiritual science wants to pursue individual branches of science in such a way that they will gradually lead toward spiritual science. We need the materialistic culture outside. And those anthroposophists are wrong who say, "What do I care about materialistic culture? It is none of my business. It is for crude materialists. I cultivate that which you experience when you dream, when you are not quite fully conscious. The other stuff is none of my business. I have the teachings of reincarnation and karma," and so on. On the other side, there is the world out there that says, "We have the real science, the serious and worthy methods. And here, now, come the anthroposophists with their spiritual science. They are the very purest of fools." It must not remain at this opposing position, and mediation cannot be expected to come from outside. Mediation must come from inside. We must understand and not get lazy and say, "If you first have to climb up into the spiritual world through science, that is much too laborious for us." I wanted to speak about the importance of materialistic culture and draw your attention to it, because as I have often emphasized, materialism comes from Ahriman. But we have to know about Ahriman, just as we have to know about Lucifer and reckon with him. And the Trinity, which we were able to look at yesterday on the model, is the one with which humanity will have to acquaint itself. I would like to repeat once again, do not try to annoy the outside world by talking about a new religion. If we were to speak of the group as a, in quotes, Christ statue, that would be a big mistake. It is sufficient to say, there stands the representative of humanity. Everyone can see what is meant. It is important that we always find the right words. That is, that we consider how we should place ourselves in the whole world of culture and how we wish to arrive at describing the matter with the right words. That is the thing that must be repeated over and over again. Let us not say to others, "Only here do we have the representation of the real Christ." We may know that and keep it to ourselves. It is important for us to acknowledge all the blessings of materialistic culture. Otherwise, we will commit the same mistake as the others who do not examine things. Let's ask ourselves if we don't do the same with regard to the others. While we need not withhold true judgment, we must understand what is going on outside. Then we will also be able to approach what is outside in the right words. But, my dear friends, we will have much, much to do in this regard, because the laziness of which I have spoken today is very, very widespread, and we must find the courage to say to people, "You are too lazy to enter into the activity of thinking." If we understand what is outside, then we may also use strong words, engage in a vigorous fight. But we have to familiarize ourselves with it and draw the threads to outer culture. That is why I also wanted to give an example with Wrangel's very meritorious pamphlet, which shows how someone is strong as a scientist but has not concerned himself sufficiently with the spiritual scientific worldview, yet through the whole direction of his soul is inclined toward spiritual science. We have often shown how such threads can be drawn, mostly using concrete personalities. And I advise you, where there are branches, to do this also in collaboration. Of course, this cannot be the work of just one person. They would never be able to finish. But there must be someone who, say, takes on a pamphlet on Eucken's worldview, and another takes a pamphlet that deals with the blood, muscular, and nervous systems, and so on. And they work through them with others. This can be work done in the branches. This can be arranged in such a way that you work purely on spiritual science on one branch evening, and then go through such a subject on the next. If one person did it one day, another person can do it another time. Everyone can use something as a starting point that is of interest to them in some way. And why should someone who has no scientific training at all not also be able to use one or another subject as a starting point? There are questions of life that can also be linked to such things. It is much more useful to use the time for such studies than to extract all sorts of occult complexities and material from dreams and tell people about it. This is not meant to be one-sided either. It is not to say that you can never speak of occult experiences, but it is about drawing the right connecting line. It is not a question of despising the science of the senses, but of mastering it. The science of the senses is not to be trampled to death or destroyed, but mastered. The end of Lecture 9.